Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. On today's program, historian Jeffrey Wirt explains the significance of Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, which some consider his greatest speech. Lincoln delivered the address 149 years ago this week. But first, we remember Colonel Gerald Russell. He was one of the most decorated Marines in World War II, an associate dean at Penn State, and one of Center County's most dedicated community volunteers. Known to many as simply the Colonel, he died on February 24th. He was 97. Here's our last interview with him, recorded in May of 2007. The 36-day campaign to capture Iwo Jima was the bloodiest in the history of the U.S. Marines, and it was the only one in which the Marines' losses exceeded those of the Japanese. We're going to talk about that campaign with a World War II Marine veteran who also happens to be the last living infantry battalion commander who had Navajo code talkers assigned to him. Colonel Gerald Russell served 30 years in the Marine Corps. He fought in the first U.S. offensive of World War II at Guadalcanal, was second in command of his battalion at Iwo Jima, and served as chief advisor of a frontline Korean Marine Brigade, among other things. Today, he's an active member of the Marine Corps League and the Nittany Leathernecks, a service organization based in State College, Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity to be here.
On February 19, 1945, you were the second in command of the 2nd Battalion when you and your men landed in the third wave assault on Iwo Jima just 17 minutes after the first troops landed there. Tell us a bit about that assault and why this 3x5 island known as Iwo Jima was so important.
Well, by the time the operation was scheduled, the United States had pretty much defeated the Japanese, and it was obvious that in order for them to be totally defeated and acquiesce in the defeat, we had to land on the mainland. But before we could land on the mainland, we had to neutralize their industrial sites and their military centers. And at this early, in late 1944, the Germans had been pretty much defeated in Europe, and coincident with that had been the introduction of this huge bomber aircraft, which had a greater load capacity and a greater range than any aircraft that we'd ever had before. So it was an ideal coincidence to be able to have it, to utilize it to neutralize the mainland of Japan. And these aircraft in great numbers were established on a base at the island of Tinian. In their route from their base to the mainland of Japan as they progressed directly north, they passed over a very small island, 5 miles long and about 2.5 miles wide at its widest point. On that island were several squadrons, Japanese squadrons of fighter aircraft and an air warning system. So as the planes went north to the target area, they were harassed by the fighter planes. And then the air warning system notified the mainland that these aircraft were coming, so they were on the alert and waiting for them. So it was an all-around very bad situation, and we were beginning to have heavy casualties of these huge aircraft. It was determined that it was necessary to eliminate the island of Iwo Jima. So the Marines were assigned the mission, and as you indicated, on February 19, 1945, we made the landing, we had the mission of eliminating it.
Which was no easy mission. You say the Marines paid dearly for every inch of terrain that you captured
it's
there.
It's the worst battle from a casualty standpoint the Marines were ever involved with. We lost 6,915 men killed in the 36-day operation. We also had 19,000 wounded, of which I was one, and that's probably the greatest, it is the greatest in the history of the Marine Corps, and it's probably one of the greatest in the history of the United States, that number of casualties.
The Japanese had miles of underground tunnels and countless spider holes on the slopes of Mount
Suribuchi. It's an amazing phenomenon. I had the opportunity to go through. They had, on this five-mile island long from one end to the other, they had 17 kilometers of connecting tunnels, all at least 30 feet below the surface. So no matter how heavy the bombardment was, and, you know, it was hit heavily by our Army Air Corps aircraft and by our naval ships, they were impervious. Mm-hmm. They were protected. So there was no way that we could get to them. And throughout the 36-day campaign, it was individual against individual to eliminate them.
On the fifth day of this campaign, the photograph, that famous, most famous photograph I think ever taken by Joe Rosenthal of the flag raising took place. You were there, you knew Joe Rosenthal, and you actually witnessed that flag going up.
I knew him, met him later, but the troops finally got to the point where they arrived at the top of the mount. It was the highest point on that island, so it was logical that we put the American flag up to show that we had captured it.
Although there was 31 days of fighting after this flag went up.
Absolutely, and it was never any easier from the time we put the flag up. That's just a signal that we had taken that piece of high ground. The reason for the two flags, I knew the battalion commander, a fellow named Lieutenant Colonel Johnson, who, when his troops were getting near the top, he said he had a personal flag of his own that many of the commanders would carry. And he said, when you get up to the top, put this flag up, let us know and let everybody know that we've finally taken the highest ground on the island. And that's how the first flag went up. It became so obvious that when the cheering and all the ships and everything saw this tiny flag, it was essential that we even have
impact.
A bigger one. And that's when the group bringing the second flag up, Joe Rosenthal happened to be with several other photographers and newsmen, and he went up with them, and he got there just at the point that they were changing the flag. They're putting the larger flag up, and he just flashed his camera. And in those days, they didn't develop them right there on site. They, for example, were sent by aircraft from a carrier that was there to Guam, which was the nearest the United States base.
So he didn't know what a treasure he had
didn't
captured.
Know, he, as a matter of fact, the people in Guam developed it and saw what appeal it probably would have, and they sent it. Joe Rosenthal didn't know that he was the greatest photographer of all times. It was surprising to him. And I met him later at a reunion. He's a very fine individual, and I do have one of his originals
autographed, right. So.
If you're just joining us, I'm Patty Satalia, and this is Take Note on WPSU.
Colonel Gerald Russell, a decorated Marine, respected educator at Penn State, and volunteer in his state college community, died on February 24th at age 97. He was awarded a track scholarship to attend Boston College, where he earned a degree in history and was named first alternate for the 1940 U.S. Olympic team in the 800 meters. The games were canceled due to World War II. After graduation, he enlisted in the United States Marine Corps and was commissioned second lieutenant. He was wounded at Guadalcanal, and at the Battle of Iwo Jima, one of the bloodiest battles in American history, he witnessed the raising of the American flag at Mount Suribachi. He was the last living infantry battalion commander who had Navajo code talkers assigned to him, a subject we talked about in this 2007 interview.
You were the last surviving infantry battalion commander who had Navajo code talkers assigned to you. Tell us a little bit about these Navajo Marines, because they were Marines first, and what they did for your unit.
Well, first of all, I'm one of the last living infantry battalion commanders. Coincidentally, I also happen to have two of these code talkers. The system we developed in the Marine Corps was to we realized the potential for the utilization of Native American speech to send messages. And the Marine Corps early in the game selected 400 Navajo Marines and then trained them in a special way to be code talkers. And the reason we had they were Marines, first of all, and they were very proud of it, and they are to this day. There are certain words in that certain thing, submarine, for example. They had to come up with a name for submarine. They don't have it in the
Navajo language, right.
So, in fact, they came up with
iron fish, which makes sense.
So there are certain words that there's no comparable, certain English words, there's no comparable Navajo words, so they came up with it. And they also abbreviated a lot to expedite
the
transmission.
The Japanese never broke that code.
The Japanese admitted, since the long time afterwards, that they broke every code that we had. The one that they never could break or understand was a Navajo speaking in Navajo, and that quite obviously why.
Sadly, the two Navajo code talkers that were assigned to you,
I had two in official capacity. Paul Kinlochine and James Gleason. They were both casualties on the fifth day, coincident with the
flag raising.
I did have several needs to use them. And, of course, we only used them if we were concerned about disclosure of the information would give away a set. For example, if we were sending a message and informing a higher command that we were short of personnel at a certain point, a possible breakthrough, or that we were running out of ammunition at a certain point, and so forth. So that would be information that we would have to be certain that the Japanese, could not.
And they did this rather quickly. The translation.
Well,
was,
as an example, I had several requirements to send this sensitive type of information, and I would write out the message, hand it to the code talker, who would transpose it into Navajo. And then he'd call his counterpart at the command that I was sending it to, and he would nod when he acknowledged that the message had gone through. And then later, I would see him with his headpiece, and then he'd be writing out the message, which would be the response from the organization that I had sent the message to. Regrettably, Paul was killed outright on the fifth day, and James was badly wounded, and again, it's all coincident with the flag raising, the fifth day. James landed in a shell hole, and we tried to get aid to him, but the Japanese had it under surveillance, and we were having tremendous casualties
trying to
get to him. Finally, we could do nothing to help him without suffering great casualties. The night of the second day, we finally were able to get him, and so we sent him out to the hospital ship. And because of the delay, I guess, they had to amputate his leg. And I heard many years later that all James wanted to do, even with his one leg, was to get back to duty with the Marines. And his wife said that that was his greatest disappointment, that he couldn't get back to duty with the Marines. He lived 17 years afterwards.
You've had an occasion to actually meet with the last surviving Navajo code talkers. I think there are 13 maybe of the 400 or so who were trained in this special code.
There are 13 that we know of. There may be more than that. Interestingly, the reason we don't know how many they're still surviving is because the code was so successful, or the method of communicating was so successful, that the Defense Department decided to put a hold on it, and maybe if we had another occasion, another war, it would be available for utilization at that point in time. So it meant that these poor Native Americans, these Navajo Marines, had to go back home. They couldn't tell their family what they did or anything else. It was just a complete blackout for them. And that transpired for about 15 years, and finally they changed it and, you know, disclosed that they had other better methods, seemingly at least, than the Navajos. So because of this lack of being able to talk about it, we lost track of a lot of them. So we don't know really how many are. Now, there is a documentary being produced in... they have lined up about 13 of them, and those are the ones that I have met with.
In fact, they invited you to what is a sacred ground for the Navajo, Window Rock.
Window Rock is a sacred ground for the Navajos, and there are a number of occasions. That's a number of occasions where I met with them. For example, that right picture right there is an indication of me speaking to them, and it took a while for me to be accepted as one of them. The reason that people producing the documentary wanted me available was to have somebody who could get them to talk about their experiences. Among themselves, they would talk about what they did, but to any other than the code talkers, they would not talk about it. And gradually, I was able to get them to begin. They accepted me after a while because we could talk. We had something in common. And I gradually got them to speak about their experiences, which will be in the documentary.
The Marines have a saying, those who talked the most did the least, and I know that you and so many other Marines have been very, very quiet for decades about your experiences in World War II, and of course now, as the last survivors, so many people want to hear your story. How difficult is it to talk about even today?
Well, I don't think it's characteristic of me alone, but I think that most individuals who have been in combat really don't like to talk about their own personal experiences. I don't mind talking I'm reluctant to even talk about, you know, any of the experiences that I was involved with. But as time has gone on, I have been able to talk about what my men did Not what I did, but what my men did. And I don't think it's important we talk about what I did. But I do want credit given to the great Marines who served with me. And so I will talk to some extent about that. But I don't see any need for me to tell about my experiences.
Mm. I want to end with this, because in 2000, you went back to Red Beach, to Iwo Jima, for the 55th anniversary of that. What was it like to be on that beach again?
I stood on the beach where I landed, black volcanic sandy beach right there. We landed it's right at the base of Mount Suribachi, the high point. And it was the strangest feeling. It wasn't a feeling of guilt, but it was just a very unusual feeling. I guess best summed up by the question, why am I here? And all those wonderful men that I serve with, men that we trained together, we worked together, I knew their families, and so much about them, and then all of a sudden their life ended on this little island, and here I am. I've been so fortunate to be able to go on and accomplish a lot of things and everything. And it's, I guess, the question, why me? Why was I? And I still wonder.
You survivor sort of made a vow, and we just have a couple of seconds remaining, though. But to honor those men, can you talk just for a second about sort of the pledge you made when you said goodbye, farewell to those who were left there on the island?
Well, I guess the gist of it would be that what you did, the sacrifice that you made, will not be in vain, and we will make certain that we will always extend great effort to assure that the freedoms you gave your life for, that is so characteristic of our country, will never in any way be allowed not to be as strong as ever.
All right. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking
with
you.
Well, it's been great having the opportunity, and I thank you very much.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. That was Colonel Gerald Russell from an interview recorded in 2007. He died February 24th at 97. He was one of only two surviving Iwo Jima Battalion commanders at the time of his death. Remembered for his life of service, he was buried with full military honors at Arlington National Cemetery. Next, Civil War historian and author Jeffrey Wirt spoke at the National Civil War Museum in Harrisburg for a Penn State alumni event. His focus was Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, which Lincoln delivered 149 years ago this week. WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner spoke with Wirt about the speech, which some consider to be Lincoln's finest.
Jeffrey Wirt, thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
It's been 149 years since Lincoln's second inaugural address. Most of our listeners are familiar with the Gettysburg Address and why that's important. What's the significance of this less talked about speech, which some, including Lincoln, actually considered his greatest speech?
The language is very moving, and it's almost a speech in which Lincoln's removed from it. Only in the first paragraph is there the I, but after that it's very impersonal. He talks about the coming of the war and who's to blame for it. And he attributes it correctly to slavery. And then he basically calls it a national sin. He says that this nation has paid for that sin. And they're paying for that sin with this terrible civil war. Both the North and the South has to pay for the sin of, as he called it, the unrequited labor for 250 years of slaves, and if it was drawn with the lash, it is now being drawn with the sword. It's unlike any other inaugural address in our history. That's clear. Well, of course, Lincoln arguably is unlike any other president in our history with his command of language.
Well, let's back up a little bit. What's the context of the speech?
Well, the context was the war would be over in 5 weeks. most of the thousands of people in the audience pretty well knew that the end was at hand. And so therefore, he said it was not necessary to go over the progress of the war. So then he reminds the audience that once this war ends, there's this great task remaining before us. He alluded to the fact that there's no certain answers to what happens after the war, and that we know is Reconstruction. So as the war's ending is approaching, it's a look in a sense forward besides a look in the past.
It's worth noting that the speech was quite short. It was around 700 words, and Lincoln is speaking, you know, towards the end of the war. There's a lot he could talk about, but he chooses to be brief.
He not only chooses to be brief, but if you think about it, it's a rather harsh speech to the American people in the fact that, you know, we have as a nation, as I said before, sinned. And this is what we are paying for that sin, and it's God's will. And that's the other thing about the speech. This inaugural address is very profound in its religious undertones. If you will. In fact, you could argue that it's even more than an undertone. He quotes Matthew in the speech. So most inaugural addresses, as we know, modern times, it's almost saying, well, either if it's the first term, it's what we're going to achieve. If it's the second term, it's what we have achieved and then looking forward. This was none of that applied here necessarily. As I said, it's a very impersonal address.
And why do you think he chose that tactic?
I believe he chose that because he felt that it had to be said, and American people had to understand. And as I said earlier, it's preparing them for a clearly uncertain future about how do we heal this? And today we believe that perhaps not 620,000 men fell from disease or battle wounds, but perhaps maybe 750,000. So we're talking 750,000 men, and we have obligations to that. And it is a very difficult mission. Of course, sadly and tragically, we know that he didn't live to do that.
What's the lasting significance of this speech?
It's just the poetry of it all. It has never been matched. We think of Kennedy's moment, but Kennedy had a phrase that just rang. But Lincoln's entire speech just rings.
Would you mind reading the last paragraph?
Oh, no, certainly. With mouths toward none, with charity for all, with the firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who has borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which we may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner talking with historian Jeffrey Wirt. He's the author of 9 books about Civil War history. His book, Gettysburg Day 3, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. Wirt lives in Center Hall. If you have story ideas for Take Note, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is stories@psu.edu. For Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.